My name is Ryan Ware. I am the security lead in Intel's Open Source Technology Center. And I'm also Intel's IVI security architect. So I want to talk a bit here about IVI security. I actually created these slides for a different conference. It's actually an hour's worth of material. I will try to make sure to sensibly cram it into 40 minutes. But at the same time, if anybody has any questions as I go through this, please don't hesitate. I want to make sure that you guys have all of your questions answered. So, go forward. Forward? No. Well, another technical difficulty. Hold on a second. Okay. Who shall I vaporize? Hey, there we are. So, you know, the onslaught is coming, all right? Now, I know a lot of people are in the audience going, okay, Ryan, you're being a little melodramatic here. You know, we aren't having to protect ourselves from the Persians, and God, hopefully we aren't the Spartans, because I want to live through this. But to be honest, there are a number of different trends that really, really concern me when it comes to IVI products. And when I started talking or thinking about doing this talk, you know, the thing that I thought about was like, okay, well, where has IVI been? Where is it going? Let's go ahead and look at my personal cars here. Let me go look and see what the trend there has been. So, you know, this was my wife's car a while ago. It's a 2002 Honda Odyssey. It has an entertainment system in it. Thank God, because driving down to California without a video system in my car with my daughters would have been crazy. But, you know, it has a DVD player, AV input, CD, analog radio, no IP connectivity in it at all. It has a threat space that is the physical perimeter of the car. You know, if you want to create a security concern for somebody who has one of these, you actually have to get physical access to the car. Okay, that's great. That's easy to defend against for the most part. You know, now I'm driving a 2011 Nissan Juke. A lot of people say it looks like a bionic frog, but it has more than just the entertainment system embedded in the car. So it has digital music that you get from XM satellite. It has traffic data, AV inputs, USB, Bluetooth, CD, analog radio. The threat horizon for my car actually includes a satellite out in orbit, right? You know, you could say, okay, well, that's not really that big because, I mean, it's just the satellite. And I'd have to agree, it's mostly self-contained with the satellite. If somebody hacks into the satellite, I think XM radio has more problems than just my car. Now, we're going into the future now. By the way, if anybody can build this car for me, I'll be happy to buy it. But we're going into a very different place. So our cars in the future are not going to be connected to just a satellite. They're going to be on the internet all the time while your car is up. Not only are you going to have internet music, interactive navigation, app stores, cellular, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, go get arbitrary applications from an app store to just go run on your car. And not only that, the system's not going to be completely separated. You're actually going to be able to have read ECU information and also potentially in the long run even look at sending information to the ECU. So there's a bit of a concern here from my side. So where are we going with all of this? So we've gone from a universe where you have almost no connectivity outside of the car, and to a universe where you are completely connected to the internet, where I can, from my house in Portland, go really muck up my father's day in Florida while he's driving his car. Yes, question. I am saying that I have talked with people that want to connect the CAN bus network to this system to be able to, at first, essentially, at least read data. Yes, correct. And I want to emphasize at first. So, yes. Yeah, I know. I mean, it's not like it's, you know, all that far. So, you know, I mean, with this, the threat horizon is the entire planet, right? Anything that's on the network. So, you know, let's talk a little bit about who we're protecting from. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, it's not your mother's hacker anymore, okay? A lot of people, when they think about hackers, they think about this guy, right? This is the guy that lives in his mother's basement and never leaves the house, right? I have known many of these guys in my time. They are not in this mode anymore. Most of them have grown up. Now, you know, we all think of hackers this way. Hackers like to think of themselves like this. You know, they aren't, but what they really are these days is they're much more like these guys, okay? So, you know, these guys are just smart geeks that want a job and need to make money, right? You know, sure, if you watch the show, they're physicists, but close enough. They've grown up and they need jobs. They can no longer necessarily, well, except for Howard, live in his mother's basement. So where am I going with all of this? There is a very different driving force in the community these days for why attacks happen. So this all is the broad spectrum of attackers for systems. So on the bottom horizontal axis, you are going in increasing capability. So script kiddie, hobbyist hacker, expert, specialist. And on the vertical axis are increasing impact of what they're doing, okay? So down here in the lower left-hand corner, I mean, we're talking about script kiddies that, you know, these are the little guys that you could think of like 5 years ago that were defacing websites and, you know, trying to get themselves noticed. I would hope that with IVI systems, one of our goals is to try to protect from those guys. If we can't protect against those guys, we're kind of hosed. Now, in the upper right-hand corner, you know, these are all places like CIA, NSA, GCHQ, you know, intelligence agencies of national interest. While I would love to be able to say, hey, yeah, we're going to ship a Tizen system and they won't be able to hack into it, I don't think that's the case, and I don't think that should also be our goal. We are never going to be able to create a system that, given the amount of resources that they have, that we can actually viably protect against them. But between those two, there is a broad range of people and capabilities. So one of the things I want to point out is this area right here. It is the fastest growing segment of this graph. Okay. Now, who are these people? These people are generally what I would consider black hats, who are very, very knowledgeable about computer security. And what motivates them? So what really motivates them is money. And why do they, you know, you go, okay, money, great. Where do they get money from? So to talk about where they get money from, let me give you an example. So there is a computer security conference that I regularly go to. It is in Vancouver, Canada, and it's called CANSEC West. It's usually held in March every year. Unfortunately, OSTS has conflicted with it the last 2 years, so I haven't been able to go. But every year they have a contest called Pwn to Own. I know, great hacker name, but at Pwn to Own in 2008, they had $120,000 in prize money. That prize money was split between operating systems for desktop systems and mobile devices. Of the $60,000 for mobile devices, it was $15,000 for each of four different devices. So there was iPhone, there was Android, there was BlackBerry, and there was Symbian. Of course, iPhone dropped 5 minutes. It was gone. So if any of you have iPhones out in the audience, you're screwed. But at the same time, especially you, Chris, I know you have an iPhone. So I was talking to one of the guys who was looking at the Android device. And he, I was talking to him, and he had a hack for Android. He was showing it to me. He walked me through the code, and he showed me how he was able to root his own device that he had. And I was like, well, you know, why aren't you doing it? Well, go. He's like, you know, $15,000 is good, but I can get more money for this elsewhere. $15,000 was not enough. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, I could have a down payment for a car. But he thought it wasn't enough, and he kept it to himself. 6 months later, he was able to get $100,000 for that particular vulnerability by selling it to a third party. I don't know who the third party was, but in general, third parties who buy these kind of things are third world governments who are trying to spy on their citizens, organized crime, or even security companies. So there's actually literally a lot of money involved in a lot of these things now. So they have a very big motivation. The other area here that is very interesting is people who are white hats. Like, I guess people might consider me a white hat. So these are all people that, you know, do security research out in the open. They make tools. These are very, very good tools that are very sophisticated but very simple to use. So to give a perfect example, there is a security researcher in Iran who created a tool to do SQL injection of databases. The tool is so simple, it's ridiculous. You put in the URL of the website, and there's a button that says scan. And it will go through, and it will find the database hooked up driving that website, and it will look for any vulnerability it knows about. And then once it generates all that, it brings up a button that says own. That's it. And once you do that, you can go ahead, you have administrative access in the database. You can do whatever you want. And, you know, it's not that, you know, I mean, guys like the creators that are very smart and understand what the tools do, they create these things because it makes their lives simpler. But then, unfortunately, these tools get down into these guys who, these are people who don't really understand necessarily how the tools work. Or they might think that they know, but they don't really. And they use these to trespass for personal fame and to steal stuff. This is a big problem, and it is not a trend that is going to go away anytime soon. There's something else that I want to talk about here real quick. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so there are definitely ways where we will be able to sandbox applications to help, you know, applications that behave badly, not necessarily maliciously, will be able to be contained. And I'll get to some of that here in a little bit. The information in this graph really scares me. So, you know, why has Windows been the biggest target? Well, if you're going to go develop software for a platform as a generic developer, what are you going to go choose? Well, let's see. Windows has an install base, at least as of the end of last year, of 1.25 billion units. So that's a very large potential customer base for your software, as opposed to the Linux desktop of 8 million. Okay? So if I'm going to go write malware, there's a lot of money to be involved, be had by creating botnets and generating spam. So, hey, you know, I'm going to go after Windows. Even if it's just Windows 7, that's 400 million systems. That's a lot. That's why Windows has been the biggest target for a long time. Yes, question? In many cases, it is, yes. Sure. The thing that scares me here is we are going from a environment where, you know, the number of Linux systems out on the network were, you know, around 8 million Linux desktops to we have 234 million Android phones that are out there being used today. We have 13 million tablets and, you know, the Linux desktops, of course, plus all of the servers that are out there. I can't actually find real numbers for Linux servers. So that becomes globally as a Linux desktop or a Linux system, a very enticing target for malware developers. And with Tizen and any of these Linux distributions, you know, that is the world we're going into. There's also, you know, I want to talk about the Mac OS flashback here just for a minute. With Mac OS flashback, you know, if you looked on the slide before, the Mac install base is about 58 million. So, I mean, you know, significant, but from a monetary point, although it's a growing market, it's still, you know, you can get some growth out of your investment, but not like you can with Windows or other big, large, huge install bases. The primary motivation with things like this is fame. Sure, you look at this, you know, they attacked Apple because of Apple's $70 billion brand name. It is one of the largest companies in the world, one of the best well-known. Actually, yeah, so currently if you go look, there's 2.6 million hits if you go look for Mac OS flashback. It's a very buzz-generating thing right now. Apple has been thrashing over this. They've shipped 3 security updates over this so far. And all of this is because of 600,000 infected Macs. That is 1.05% of the install base. That is a lot of effort and work over something that's only 1% of the install base. Now, if we encounter something similar with IVI, just 1% of the install base, it's going to create a huge problem for us. Now, let's go back in time. So one of the things about IVI that scares me is that we have a 10-year product life cycle that we're talking about. So let's go back 9 years to the wonderful year of 2003. Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers had come out just the December before. Johnny Cash was covering Nine Inch Nails, Hurt. And Mike Myers just threw his career away. So if we were shipping an IVI product at this time, we would probably have been using something that was mature and around for a while, like Red Hat Linux 9. Okay? So what would we be stuck with now? So Red Hat Linux 9 shipped with kernel 2.4.20. Okay? It had wonderful things like brand new since Red Hat Linux 8. It had a POSIX thread library. Ooh. It had beta ACPI support, access control list, user mode Linux. You know, these are all things we not only take for granted now, but some of them have peaked in their usage and have trailed way off. X-Free 4.3. How many people run X-Free in their Linux systems now? GNOME 2.2. There have been 18 major releases of GNOME since then. KDE 3.1. There is no real KDE 3.x code base anymore. So Mozilla, this is before Firefox. OpenSSL 0.97a, so a key piece of security for the system. It would be not only 12 versions old, but it will not have been gotten security updates since 2006. Okay? So what does all this really mean? I'm short on time, so I'm going to skip this graph. Just think of CVEs as public security announcements about vulnerabilities, CVSS as a way to give those a priority, and CWEs as a way to categorize what those are. So let's play Wheel of Linux Kernel Fortune, okay? So what are the number of vulnerabilities of the Linux kernel publicly known in 2003? Can somebody guess? I'm going to pick on somebody if somebody doesn't throw up a number. What? 20. Who said that? And you didn't even see my talk before. It's 19. That's really good. So anybody want to guess for 2004? No, 51. 2005? Huh? 2005 is 133. Okay. 2006 is 90. And, you know, 2007, 63, 70, 105, 124, and 83. So over a period of 9 years, we are talking about 1.53 public security notices against the Linux kernel every week. When you're trying to keep a system updated out in the field that is on the network all the time, these numbers should scare the bejesus out of you. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, oh, okay, actually, by the way, I have this all broken out. And, you know, what kind of vulnerabilities? It's actually a total of 738. And, you know, denial of service, code execution, overflow. You might be thinking to yourself, well, hey, Ryan, you know what? Sure, 738 CVEs, not all of those are critical. And, you know, fair enough. That's perfectly fine. So what are the critical ones? These here are starting from 2003. And each and every one of these has a CVSS score of between 8 and 10. In almost all cases, these are all remotely exploitable without end-user intervention, okay? So, you know, things like denial of service or root privilege escalation, arbitrary code execution, denial of service or arbitrary code execution, denial of service. You know, these nine here are all critical things that not only would make your products vulnerable out in the real world, these all would have caused a fire drill every time one of these public CVEs came out, because you would have to go figure out how to update all of these systems out in the field. And, oh yeah, these are nine, by the way. Here's another screen with nine, okay? So you would be averaging over 9 years one fire drill just for these every 6 months, okay? And this is for just one package in our hypothetical Linux IBI system that we shipped in 2003, okay? This doesn't include GNOME or any of the middleware or anything else on the system. You look really comfortable with that thought, Adam. So, okay, I'm not here to say that we're all screwed. We actually have a chance of really, really doing this and doing it right. So, you know, we need to be able to protect ourselves and to make sure that we can do this in an appropriate way that allows us to really ship product out there. So how do we do that? So one of the key things here is to reduce your attackable surface area. And by the way, you know, up till this point, I've been talking about, you know, hackers and vulnerabilities and all of the sexy things about security. It gets kind of boring from this point on. One interesting thing about security is, you know, you talk about hackers and conferences, and it all sounds very interesting, and then you go, okay, well, here's the things that you actually can do to fix it. And it's like, oh, well, that sounds like work. But these are actually all very sensible things that will help save you a lot of work in the long run. So reducing the attackable surface area, you know, any unused functionality that you include in a product is just something there for an attacker to go use against you. You aren't using it, and if you aren't using it, that likely means it wasn't validated very much. And if it wasn't validated very much, it likely has bugs that can be exploited. Of those CVEs that I had up there, of the critical ones, about half of them would have been would have not affected our hypothetical system, unless, for example, specifically a specific driver was needed to do it for our system. So just reducing the attackable surface area actually fixes many, many issues. Least privilege. So I cannot tell you how often I will be in a discussion with a developer and he'll go, yeah, but I run my application as root. Why can't I do that? And my answer always is, okay, you're root. So does that mean your app with your application, you need to actually physically memory map everywhere in physical memory? There are very few applications that actually need to do that. And, you know, a generic daemon for a network socket is not one of them. You know, you do not want to run stuff as root. It is, of course, easier to run, but, you know, another thing that I always tell them is like, okay, well, if you need performance and that's why you're doing it as root, why don't you run it in the kernel? You'll get even better performance. No ring zero to ring three transitions. There are reasons why we have these separations. When your software fails, it does mean that, and everybody's software does fail. The only person who writes perfect code is me, so. Yes, I was laughing all the people who have seen my code. You know, when your app fails, yes, question. So ring three drivers, yes, they do exist, and they are viable for some applications. You do have to balance security and performance. So I'm not saying you have to go run everything in ring three. At the same time, you have to, with forethought, think about what you're going to run in ring zero. You just don't default to running everything in ring zero. Or default to running everything with complete privilege. That's just from that's just going to make you have a product that fails in the marketplace because it's going to get attacked very quickly. So, does that make sense? Okay. Anyway, least privilege is a security concept you need to focus on. Use compiler defenses. You know, Probably 3/4 of the security CVEs for the critical ones would have been fixed by using these compiler defenses. So make sure you're using position-independent code for your executables and your libraries. Using fstack protector. Fstack protector puts what's called a canary value on the stack for every stack frame. And if somebody overwrites it, you've had issue. Fortify source, it has it silently replaces a number of the string functions that are unbounded with bounded versions of those string functions. You might think, oh crap, it's changing what function I'm using. In my personal experience, I've never seen this break something. I've seen people on mail list complain, but I haven't actually seen it myself. You know, you want to use the NX bit, or as Intel calls it, the XD bit, to disable execution of your data pages on your stacks. Mandatory access controls. So with Tizen, you know, there are a number of different mandatory access control solutions that we could use. All of them are LSMs in the upstream kernel. For Tizen, we have decided on using SMAC, Simplified Mandatory Access Control Kernel. If you had the pleasure of meeting Casey Schaffler yesterday, who is the creator and upstream maintainer of SMAC, you know, he if you want, he will talk to you for hours on end about SMAC. Sometimes it's hard to get him to be quiet about it. But one of the reasons why we chose it is the SE Linux reference policy has more than 900,000 lines in it. It's very, very difficult to try to determine exactly what something of that size is really, really doing. So with SMAC, we're able to create something that's much more simple, that gives us the granularity of security domains that we want, and yet, at the same time, allow us to have only a list of rules that's maybe 50 to 100 lines long, something that is very easily understandable. Another thing that we're going to go into, I hope all of you were able to go to see Auka Cook talk about systemd and what we're doing with that. One of the nice things about systemd is we want to, or is that it uses C groups, and it also has some Linux container-like capabilities. So it allows us to put processes in different process namespaces, different IPC namespaces, network namespaces. We're going to be looking at utilizing some of this functionality here in the not-too-distant future. Linux containers, I just talked a little bit about that. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip this for now. And integrity, some of the things that we're doing with integrity checking. So integrity measurement architecture, or IMA, is a way of when a system is up and running, being able to verify that files were not modified in an unwanted way by malicious software. So it keeps a list of hashes for the files in kernel memory. And whenever a file is opened, it checks the hash, verifies the hash, makes sure the file is fine and has not been touched. Unfortunately, of course, the kernel cannot actually do those kind of checks while the system is off. So we actually have a way of doing offline checking as long as the system has a hardware security module like a TPM in it. So what it will do is it keeps what's called a hashed MAC over specific parts of the file. And that hashed MAC is actually generated by the hardware. And if you actually go and, you know, take the drive out, go stick it in another Linux system, go modify the file and then bring it back in, it will be able to detect that once the file is accessed in the original system. There's also something that is a little bit faster, we think, than both of those, called DM Integrity, which is based on DMCrypt, and it also uses HMAC over files with hardware. Yes? It is not currently, but that doesn't mean it's not going to change in the not-too-distant future. You will probably hear more about this. And if you want, we can talk after this about it a little bit more. Summary, the environment for IVI products is changing drastically from not connected to completely connected. We have a 10-year product lifetime, and, you know, we have many different technologies and principles that we're putting forward to help make sure that IVI systems are going to be secure and be able to be product quality secure for the foreseeable future. By the way, if there's anybody here from BMW, I would like an M5 SDV system. But does anybody have any questions? Well, I know there was a lot of material to go flying through here real quick, but yes.
To get this right, Ryan, we're going to have to understand how the car manufacturers update their systems, because I don't think anybody's trying to sell this to the car manufacturers with, oh, there'll be an update, a security update a year. And there's two sides of it, right? One side is the dealers who make a huge amount of money by having to update this, and the actual process of having easy access to be able to update the cars, because they're not going to be over-the-air type updates.
Yeah, so when I was at Geneva last week, during my talk, I made sure to explicitly point out the fact of I understand their update schedule, that they don't do over-the-air update and things like that, but if they don't, they're going to have systems out in the field that are vulnerable and infected. And by the way, I thought up one really good usage model for somebody writing malicious software, besides just, you know, generating spam from all of these systems driving around. You know, you've all heard of war driving, I think, where, you know, you go look for with wireless signals and see what APs there are around. You know, just think of that on steroids, having a botnet of 100,000 war driving vehicles driving around the country. It would be an amazing amount of information they could collect. So, anyway, yes, Gavin. The overhead for most of these security technologies is actually mostly very minimal. I won't say you get it for free, you know, because there's nothing that we're going to do that's not going to cost a cycle here or there. There are some of these that we do have to be a little bit more careful about. So, for example, with MIGO, we had to turn the position independent code, the dash pick, off for BZIP2. Because depending on where it was loaded into the address space, we would actually get drastically different performance characteristics. So we do have to be careful about that. And for areas where the security technology is prohibitively expensive, we can look at being more prescriptive about what we're doing to protect that. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Any other questions?
So this is the general, you just apply some general rule for protecting your system. Mm-hmm. I think this rule can be applied to any device, not only IPI. But for the special case of IPI, my understanding is for most application is provided by professional company. So, and also the kernel you can well choose and customize. And for IPI, for the IVI device access, usually you have to use network. So does that mean we should pay much more attention to the network security, especially to protect the connection, to protect the operating system? I don't mean we don't do things on application protection, but that may be a different task in my mind.
It is a adjunct to other things that we need to do. While yes, for IVI, it is mostly professional companies that are doing stuff like this. And in general, I'm a security guy. I don't trust anybody. But in general, I trust them to be doing the right thing. That said, they want to start doing things like adding app stores. So, you know, there has been in the last year so much malware that's gotten into the Google App Store, for example. I would hate to see any of that actually get into one of these IVI systems, which, as you pointed out, might not necessarily be updated very often. So it's definitely a big problem.
No questions?
Okay. Well, thanks, everybody.